the power of the footage was so strong. Let's just like let viewers stay with the footage and not to distract them with any kind of commentary.
Sky, there are so many challenges that come with finishing a documentary, but our guest today probably faced more challenges than any of us could ever imagine.
Absolutely, Jenny. I mean, people say that making a feature doc is just like having a baby, you know, but this is an unimaginable feat. So who is it and what's the film?
So our guest today is Hao Wu, and the film is 76 Days. It is set in a hospital in Wuhan, China, just as the COVID outbreak was spreading. And it's just as intense as you can imagine. Hao partnered with two filmmakers in Wuhan who shot the whole thing, and he directed remotely, which presents its own set of challenges. It was two people who he hadn't worked with before and, you know, was getting the footage from them on a daily basis. The initial production company that wanted to make this film actually dropped out. And so he had to sort of switch gears later on.
My gosh.
Yeah. Can you imagine? But it ended up being a huge success. It was just nominated for a Peabody Award. It ended up being produced by MTV Films. And I'm sure many of our listeners have already seen it. But for those who haven't, it's streaming online.
Yeah. You know, this concept of directing remotely is something that I'm sure all of our listeners are, if not getting acclimated to, have already become quite used to. And this is the ultimate. I mean, what Hao did in making this film is just incredible. And, you know, the story of COVID obviously is one that is going to last for generations. But he and, you know, the folks who filmed it got in the ground level just when it was beginning. And that is never going to be something that someone can get again. While, you know, of course, the story will be told in many different forms from many different angles. But, you know, this is an amazing feat.
Yeah, definitely. And also just Hao's approach at the film creatively. I mean, it's pure verite. There's no interviews, there's no text cards, there's no context. Mm. It really just drops you into Wuhan and you feel like you're in the hospital in this situation. And you don't really see a lot of documentaries like that anymore that just aren't taking any shortcuts. They're just like, here it is.
Right. So many these days are so flashy and produced and this idea of just true verite is is a needle in a haystack, truly. And this, I mean, and to do this in the context that he did,
it's truly amazing. I loved talking to Hao about his creative approach and how he got over these insurmountable challenges that he faced in finishing this film and actually getting it across the finish line. So I think our listeners are gonna love this conversation as much as I did.
I can't wait to hear it. And everyone, you should go see 76 Days if you haven't. Maybe pause this episode and then watch it, and then obviously hit play again.
I'm back, yeah.
But yeah, I'm so excited to hear it. So let's get into it.
Let's get into it. This is Hao Wu and you're listening to Rough Cut.
Here we go.
First of all, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And I really enjoyed 76 Days. I mean, it feels weird to say I enjoyed it because it was so traumatic. Yeah, it was so heavy, but also such an important film. So if you could tell us a little bit about how it came about. I mean, I read that you grew up in China, you're Chinese, but now live in the US. And you were actually in China when COVID, you know, first started spreading there. Can you talk a little bit about that and how the film came about?
Yeah, it was a long and weird story. Normally, as a filmmaker, you know, my past film, People's Republic of Desire, or in my family, they're all very sort of character-driven. And normally, I shy away from newsy topics. So even in January 2020, when we started hearing about this weird pneumonia cases coming out of Wuhan, I was joking with my Chinese filmmaker friends, you know, I'm sure somebody else is going to be making it because it's going to be, you know, it's a newsy topic. Obviously, a lot of people like to follow that kind of topics. But for me, I think it just became gradually more and more personal in some ways. Like you mentioned earlier, on January 23rd, 2020, the day Wuhan was put under lockdown, I flew back from New York, where I live, to Shanghai to spend Chinese New Year with my sister's family and my parents. I made the travel plan a couple months in advance, but 24 hours before the departure time, I learned about this government's going to shut down Wuhan. So that came as a complete shock, because by that time, even though we had heard about this pneumonia cases coming out of Wuhan, nobody thought it was going to be that big. And the very fact the government was locking down an entire city of 11 million people, and really quickly after, the entire province of Wuhan, that was pretty unprecedented in the history of public health. And so a lot of us were taken by surprise. And for a while, I was debating with my partner whether to continue to take our two kids back to Shanghai. But then the very fact the government was shutting down Wuhan, was it indication the government had everything under control? Or was it more like a desperate measure because things are getting out of hand? But in the end, I decided to fly back by myself just to be safe. And just being Shanghai, China's largest city of 21 million people, during China's largest family holiday, was during COVID, was really a eerie experience. Because even though Shanghai was far away from Wuhan, as soon as Wuhan was put under official lockdown, the rest of China pretty much shut down voluntarily as well. Nobody was walking in the street. If you can imagine, like last April, beginning of April, when New York was shut down, Shanghai was worse than that. There was pretty much nobody, even though it was not under official lockdown. So that left a very strong impression on me. Also, just because during the 10 days I was in Shanghai, it was still very confusing how bad, you know, we keep on reading, learning on social media, the situation in Wuhan was pretty dire, but how did it become so bad? What had happened back in December and January? So I had a lot of questions. And in early February, when I came back to the US, a US network actually approached me, asked me if I would be interested in developing a documentary. I jumped on the project because I was like, I have so many questions. I wanted to investigate. I wanted to find out what happened. That's pretty much the origin, the initial start of this project. But later on, gradually during production, the US network dropped out, but I continued on independently.
And Wuhan was still reeling from COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And that time in February, it was early February. That's really soon after the lockdown happened. And all of us were like speculating how long the lockdown would last. Nobody knew at that time. Nobody knew. In February, a lot of things happened, right? Obviously. And the virus quickly, you know, migrated to South Korea, the cult, right? And the outbreak, and also the Princess Diamond cruise. So I think early on, when I was even doing research for this project, on one hand, I was trying to reach out to filmmakers and reporters who had started filming on the ground in Wuhan, try to get in touch with them, try to see what they had captured on camera. And at the same time, really trying to figure out what the story is about. Is it a global story or is it a China story? If it's a global story, how many countries I would follow? Because the pandemic was shifting constantly. You know, I will reach out to Japan. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, the episode pretty much ended. Then South Korea happened. And then, you know, Italy happened and Spain, right? It hit Spain and eventually came to the US. So that was one of the biggest challenges during production, trying to figure out what the film was about.
Yeah, because everything is just rapidly changing so quickly.
Absolutely.
So you got two filmmakers on board who were in Wuhan to collaborate with on this film. Can you talk about your process in selecting those people and also the challenges that came along with directing this film remotely from the US?
By mid-February, I think I've got introduced to over a dozen filmmakers in China. Vast majority of them were filming in Wuhan. There were a few filming elsewhere in China just to capture the voluntary shutdown, the nationwide voluntary shutdown. Of the people that were filming in Wuhan, some got access inside the hospital. Others were filming outside the hospital. Either they were trying to track some volunteers who tried to keep the city running because the government abruptly shut down public transportation and nobody, the restaurants were forced to close, hotels were closed. So, you know, government was not prepared for this. And then, you know, there were a lot of volunteers just step up to the plate, try to keep the city function. So someone was filming that. But as soon as I saw my eventual co-director's footage, I was like shaken because by that time I had read so much from reporting, from news stories, and sometimes via video shot on cell phones shared on Chinese social media of what happened in Wuhan. But my co-director's footage, because they were embedded inside the hospitals, they were right there in the eye of the storm, so to speak. And the way they capture the panic, the intense emotion inside the hospital, that feel like that really give, you know, some kind of immediacy, right, to the things I've been reading about. So I just decided I need to work with them. But then, because I never met with them, never collaborated with them, right? So to how to build up the trust. So that became a big challenge. So what I did was I just went to them and say, I really would like to work with you, but I know you were there doing your own thing. How can I support you to finish whatever you want to do? And then we can talk about how if after finishing whatever film, feature, short you want to do, you have footage left over, can we then discuss how I can use that footage to make a feature together? So initially the interaction is more about helping them with some, giving them some advice because both of them are really new filmmakers. Wei Shi Chen, he's a video reporter for Esquire China. He's an aspiring filmmaker. He's made couple shorts before, but he's never made feature. So, and Anonymous, he's a photojournalist. He was actually sent by the newspaper to take photos, but this is his first time shooting long form video. So sometimes I'll give them production tips, like how do you capture cutaways? You know, remind them to do cutaways and really spend a lot of time discussing the characters, which character might be interesting to spend more time on. But I think most of the credit goes to them because the situation on the front line was so chaotic. You know, some of the characters we decide, oh, could be interesting. Maybe why don't you spend more time with them? But then a couple of days later, the character might be transferred to a different hospital or they might deteriorate so much in the health, they cannot speak anymore or they even pass away. So I think in the end, I just say, try to capture as much as possible. We'll figure out the story during edit.
There's so many challenges there. I mean, you have to build up trust with your collaborators, but also just getting access to people who are in that kind of vulnerable state.
I can speak a little bit about how they gain access, how they build up trust. I think I myself try to gain access because I'm based in New York, right? When the pandemic hit New York, I tried to get access inside hospitals here to trying to film because for a while I was thinking about more like a global approach. And in the end, maybe even if not a global approach, maybe a US/China approach, just compare and contrast how these two countries or how two cities deal with the pandemic. So I was really trying very, very hard to gain access to the hospitals here. But here in the US, because the privacy concern as well as the liability, the hospital at that time, even with news reporters, I remember at the very beginning we were having very little video footage come out of the hospitals because the hospital were concerned about liabilities, right? So I couldn't get access. With my two co-directors, Wei Shi Chen, even though he was a reporter, he wasn't sent by Esquire to cover the story. He just went there because he wanted to document what's happening on the ground. But then because he has a reporter badge, even with a reporter badge in Wuhan, he was rejected by four different hospitals until in the end, he through some personal connection. Because in China, the situation is different. I think in China, the access or not access a lot of times is a political decision is rather than a legal decision. So it really depends on who you know, whether that person trusts you, and then that person on the ground can make the decision to grant you access or not. So with Wei Shi, through his own personal connection, I'm not exactly sure, maybe some family connection, he embedded himself with a medical team that was being sent from elsewhere in China to cover, to support a local hospital, because the local hospital were overwhelmed. And he arrived at a receiving hospital together with the medical team. So for a while, the receiving hospital thought he was working, as part of the medical team. That's how he gained access. And with Anonymous, since he's a photojournalist working for a local state-owned newspaper, so he already knew a lot of the hospitals. He had legitimate reason to be in there. So that's how they gain access. But once they gain access, I feel like they operated like true documentary filmmakers rather than just reporters. Because reporters, under deadline, they will spend a day or two inside and they will leave, right? But with both of them, they keep on going back. Because I feel like the reason I eventually decided to really try to build up the trust to be able to collaborate with these two was because just the way they approach the filming process, also the approach the characters in front of the camera, there's so much empathy just by looking at how they shot it, what they captured. I never felt like they were trying to exploit the situation there. You feel like even when they film people suffering, they keep a distance. There's so much empathy there. And also, obviously, technically, I knew they could shoot because they can hold this, they hold the emotion. They you know, so because a lot of times working with new documentary filmmaker or cameraman, they cannot hold the shots, right? But these two have great instinct. So that's why I picked to work with them, because I see their sensibilities are pretty much in sync with my how I would approach filming. Because they spend so much time inside of hospitals, working with the doctors, spending time with the doctors and patients. So that's why they were able to build so much trust with the characters. And lastly, I think what's weird about the hospital situation with COVID was in Wuhan, the patients were basically pretty much locked inside their hospital rooms. They were not allowed to come out and socialize, right? So to have cameramen to talk to them, for those people who are still able to talk, it's to some degree, it was a therapy for the patients as well. They want to share, especially in the very beginning, their frustration, their fear, their not knowing where their families were at that time. So it was cathartic for them to talk in front of the camera.
That's interesting. And these two filmmakers you worked with, they eventually dropped out of the film. Can you talk about what happened there?
And not necessarily dropped out. They just kind of like, there's a lot of hesitancy back in March, because I think starting in early March, it was became very obvious that the pandemic was coming to the U.S. It's affecting the U.S. now. And the Trump administration really ramped up the China flu, this kind of rhetoric, and Chinese government become really defensive as well. And the Chinese government really tried to tightly control who gets the access to story, who gets what narrative were coming out of Wuhan. Because back in February, there was almost a golden period of a lot of groundbreaking investigative reporting. Just within the Chinese media space, a lot of reporters trying to figure out what happened in the beginning. But starting March, the government really tried to tighten and control it. So there was an increase in fear within the Chinese media industry of not wanting to collaborate with anybody outside of China. Me being an independent, based in New York, even though I grew up in China, through a couple of months of communicating with them, we have built a certain amount of trust. But at the end of the day, they were like, how do we know you're gonna deliver what we discussed? How can we trust you? We don't want to give the footage to you. You in the U.S., you can do whatever you want, and maybe you do a hit piece, and get us in trouble. So yeah, in the end, I decided, you know what? I'm just gonna jump in and edit out a rough cut and show it to them. This is what we talk about. This is where a vision is. I can deliver it. So starting early April, not knowing, whether this project is viable or not, I was under quarantine anyway, right? I mean, there's nothing else I could be doing. So I really spent just like March, by late June, pretty quick, like within 2 months, I got a rough assembly together. I sent it over to them. So that's when they feel like, oh, you know, he's not just talk the talk. He's actually, you know, he can actually realize what we discuss. So that's how we started really formalizing our relationship, getting the legal agreement ready.
Mm. But I'm sorry. I thought that you said earlier in the interview that they left the project at one point. Is that
yes.
they
yeah.
leave and then come back?
But, you know, that's, I think that's in the early days when I gave the interviews, the project, it's really hard to say when the project officially started because, like I said, throughout the production process, we never signed any formal agreement. They were not work for hire for us. They were there doing their own work, right? And then, so, I mean, we didn't raise any money throughout the entire process. I didn't pay them anything. It's more like out of goodwill, like approach them, say, I appreciate what you're capturing. Can we work together? So the collaboration at the beginning was really informal. Yes, in some ways you can say they left the project, but you know, but then I guess the truth was they just decided not to collaborate with me. And then I persevered, I delivered a rough assembly and convinced them to say, okay, let's get this project formally into shape by signing some kind of legal agreement.
Okay. Okay. And one of your filmmakers is anonymous, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, it's going anonymously. Okay. Why is that because of the Chinese government, like fear of retaliation?
Yeah, I think there are two fears. He has two fears. One was in China nowadays, the government is really tightening the media discourse. What can be talked about? So even though I think in March, we started talking about how do we want to shape the film? What's our focus? We discussed to have a human-centric, right? To get away from the news clips and the headlines and all these issues. But even within that, you never know whether the government will find our depiction of the early chaos and also the very sad ending, even though, you know, it's like Wuhan emerged from the lockdown. But there's so much grief, right? So it's to me, it's a very complex and emotionally complex ending. So you never know the government's going to approve that. Because right now, the only COVID narrative the government seems to approve in China is anything has to be triumphant. You know, it has to be, you know, the hero saved the day, blah, blah, blah. So we didn't know whether the government will be okay with how we approach this lockdown. And secondly, there's increasing numbers of internet trolls in China who are ultra-nationalistic. So they will pick on any negative depiction of what happened in China, and they will attack you. That happened with a book called Wuhan Diaries that became a national news. There's a writer, local writer in Wuhan, who tried to document what happened during the lockdown in a diary format, published online. The book got published in the West, and the author was pretty much pillared on Chinese social media. She became a national enemy. So my co-director Anonymous was really nervous about that because he didn't want the internet trolls to go after him and cause him to lose his job. So that's his major concern. I mean, I keep on telling him, like, I don't think, because right now I feel like I keep on telling him what we're telling is a universal story of people trying to survive the pandemic together. But even with that, you know, he still feels worried. So in the end, before our TIFF premiere, I just said, okay, you know what? I can keep you anonymous. He actually didn't care about his credit, but I was like, I feel like we need to give you some credit because without your contribution there, we would not have the story.
Yeah, it's understandable. I think why he would want to stay anonymous given the political situation there. But related to that, I mean, one thing that struck me about the film is it doesn't really give a point of view. I mean, it doesn't really zoom out at all. It's very like ground level. Here's what's happening in the hospital. Here's what's happening in Wuhan. There's not really a lot of context or really any context given. And I'm wondering if that was a creative decision that you made, or if it was like a calculated kind of like not trying to take a political stance decision, or both.
It's a combination of both. I think on one hand, the approach reflected my own thinking as during the production and editing process. And secondly, it's also artistic because the strength of the film or the strength of the footage is this rare underground access, right, to the COVID frontline, which so far I haven't seen in any other films. So we, doing early stage of edit, we actually shot a lot. We shot outside the hospital. My collaborators have filmed some volunteers as well. They interview some of the early whistleblower doctors who were told by the government not to talk openly about this. But by the time we got access to these whistleblower doctors, it was kind of late. So what we did was pretty much just sit down interviews with them. They verbally tell what happened in the early days of the lockdown. So we did try to cut those interviews in. But anytime we cut the interviews in, even though the stories are interesting, but first of all, they were being well covered in news media, nothing new there. Secondly, kind of take the viewers out of the emotionally intense verity scenes. So artistically, it doesn't work. It actually decreases the power of the film. And secondly, I feel like in the beginning, my instinct was obviously very investigative. I wanted to find out what happened, and in the very beginning, whose fault it was that made this situation so bad, right? But really quickly, I realized as documentary film, it would be very difficult for us to do any investigative reporting because Wuhan was under lockdown. With news, you can call up somebody and talk to people. I cannot ask either of my collaborator or any other filmmaker to travel across Wuhan to film people. And secondly, I just realized, you know, it's been so well covered. I don't know if I have anything new to say, if I want to do an investigative angle or a commentary and, you know, news commentary angle. Thirdly, I think what struck me was when the pandemic hit US, that was really eye-opening for me because New York is my home. You know, I felt truly, truly, real. Once I saw my own city being shut down, people under, you know, going through fear, hospitals being overwhelmed. So, but also to see US completely fumbled in its own response to COVID-19, despite having like 2 months lead time after Wuhan was put under lockdown. So that kind of made me think, is like, what is the political lesson we need to draw from all of this? I was no longer sure. I just feel like, as the COVID was evolving when I was editing the film, and you know, even to this day, I feel like it, you know, for example, India, right? India was a success story end of last year, right? And then even like a month ago, I was reading a New Yorker piece about how India escaped this. You know, people were discussing what India did right. But then now India is hellish, right? Yeah, it's so heartbreaking what happened in India. So I just feel like with the pandemic evolving so fast, whatever commentary, whatever point of view I want to introduce to the film might be too premature. So I feel like, you know, that should be that should be a film probably later on. You know, they can look back and summarize what happened with this film. Also, because like I mentioned, the power of the footage was so strong. Let's just like let viewers stay with the footage and not to distract them with any kind of commentary.
Well, that's a very brave decision to make. And I mean, I imagine that presented a lot of challenges in the edit because it almost becomes sort of like a crutch for us to lean on interviews or throw in a text card or voiceover. Was that challenging, just taking all of this raw verite footage that you weren't even in the room for? So you obviously had to just watch all of it and form it into some kind of narrative?
It wasn't actually, because I just feel like this is the first time I didn't shoot the footage. I normally shoot and edit my own films. This is the first time it's my collaborator shot and I edited. But then still, I just remember from the very beginning when I was watching the rushes, right, all the way through the editing process, I was crying half the time. I was just because I feel like partly is because, you know, I grew up in China. I feel like these are my people. And secondly, I was living through the pandemic, you know, in New York and later in Atlanta, locked in a basement in my in-laws' house. And with everything going on, I just feel like this is resonates so much. This is truly reflective of what we're going through, the fear, the panic. So for me to go to the edit, to stay with the emotion and to emerge from it every day, that's almost like therapy for me. So I just feel like I truly immersed myself in the emotional power of the footage. I was pretty entranced by it. And then I feel like this is the kind of feeling I want to convey to the rest of the world to show how we can all connect just to the emotions. So in that way, this is the fastest edit I've ever done before, because with interviews or something, you need to worry about how the narrative is turning this interview soundbite, whether it connects to the next interview soundbite. But with this film, what ended up happening was I pretty much pick out the scenes that moved me. And then I try to obviously rearrange them in kind of a narrative structure and, you know, trusting the power of the story of the scene of the characters will move the viewers as well. That became a very emotional but also natural editing process.
That's interesting. You mentioned that the U.S. production company that originally was involved in this film eventually dropped out. At what stage did that happen, and how did MTV Films and Sheila Nevins eventually get involved?
Yeah, so the U.S. network dropped out in March. I think it's just because at that time there was a big debate about the creative direction of the film, whether it's China focused versus a global, and how to tackle the global story. We had a lot of different creative differences that in the end we parted ways. With this film, because like I mentioned, we didn't know. I mean, I didn't get to sign legal contract with my collaborators until I think July, late July. So for a long time, I didn't even know whether I had a film. First of all, I mean, this film, I never done this type of documentary with no interviews at all. Just, you know, based on verite, almost pure verite. And I didn't know whether I could build a film until late June, early July, when I had a rough cut that worked. That I feel like that kind of works. So we didn't go out for funding, and we only reached out for funding once the Toronto told us they would take the film. So we decided to go out, and then we got some funding from Sundance XTR to finish the film, and then we took the film to Toronto, thinking we might be able to sell it. But then at Toronto, most distributors already had some COVID project in production, so we couldn't find a buyer. And then after Toronto, we were just like, you know, taking the film to a lot of more regional film festivals. It was at Heartland International Film Festival where Sheila Nevins was on the jury, and she just absolutely loved the film. And then, you know, once she knew that the film's rights is still available, she just, you know, reached out to us, and everything just happened really quickly after that. They made the acquisition of the film.
Well, congratulations. I mean, it's great to see that it's on streaming platforms now. And where is the best place for our listeners to watch it?
Right now, it's on Paramount Plus. It's free streaming on Paramount Plus. And yeah, there's also the usual suspects, iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play.
Okay, cool. Great. Well, thank you so much, Hao. It's so fascinating to hear about the process of making something that's pure verite and that you're, you know, directing remotely. It's all of these things that our audience are dealing with a lot, but probably not all together in one film. So yeah, it's really fascinating. So thank you so much for having this conversation.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Rough Cut is hosted and produced by me, Jenny Butler, and Sky Dylan Robbins, and our original music is by Zach Wright.
And the podcast is part of the Video Consortium, which is a global creative network and community that unites today's nonfiction filmmakers and video journalists. You can visit videoconsortium.com, and we'd love for you to join our film family.
And we love hearing from listeners. So if you'd like to send us a note, you can find us on Instagram at roughcutpodcast, or you can send us an email, podcast@videoconsortium.com. And don't forget to rate us and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and subscribe.
Thank you, and see you soon.